Welcome to QuakeCast, the podcast for id Software's classic Quake and the games it inspired.
Hello, Quakers. I'm DumpTruckDS, and you're listening to the QuakeCast with my co-host, RC. On today's episode, we are interviewing Andrew Yoder, who's kind of new to the Quake scene, and he has a really unique take on gameplay and level design for Quake, kind of bearing out, he started in the Unreal series and kind of has made his way over to the other side in Quake. We'll talk about his approach to level design, and RC, what else are we going to talk about?
So we're going to talk about his experience working on the game Paladins too, which is kind of interesting because, you know, it's sort of a multiplayer game where in the community with Quake, we focus a lot on single player. So we're going to be talking quite a bit about multiplayer approach to design here. And believe it or not, Andrew has also done a GDC talk. So we're going to be talking a bit about that.
And we'll also discuss his unique way of getting into the game industry and some tips for folks that might be looking to do the same. And RC has a special announcement. Take it away.
It's true. That special announcement, it's been made already on the previous episode, but for the month of December 2018, over on my channel, Watch GGRC on YouTube, I am running a giveaway. That's right. It's been about 5 years or so since the channel's existed. I just decided to do sort of a celebration where I'm going to be giving away some stuff for this 5 year celebration plus Christmas holiday type of cheer. And, you know, if you go on to this video, comment, subscribe, you have a chance to win one of these cool prizes. Dump Truck, you could win a prize even.
Me?
That's right. You.
So beautiful. Great.
Great. Yeah. So make sure you head over to that video, leave a comment, subscribe, and you may be the proud owner of something really cool that was on my shelf in one of my videos.
Oh, I'll leave a comment. All right.
I also wanted to give a quick shout out to Vermin Supreme, who created this week's episode's art. Thanks, Vermin, and on with the show.
I don't know, I'm really interested in the history of video games and history in general, and I played Doom a couple of years back, like way after it first came out, but I'd been aware of it. And after playing Doom, it's like, okay, well, obviously the next thing to play is some Quake. And I don't know, I had this kind of hit or miss pattern with the old school games where I'd played some of them and not others. And I think I only played through Quake the first time, maybe 2015 or so. So pretty recent.
So you're not one of the players who actually played the game back when it was, you know, first released back in 96.
No. I played some Unreal Tournament and I played a little bit of Duke Nukem, but not Quake. Basically, I was just playing what we happened to have around the house, and Quake was not one of those.
So now how did you get seduced by Quake? Because obviously now you're invested in it with your map releases.
I think with really what got me looking at Quake again and thinking, oh, I need to actually get around to this, is seeing a lot of the cool new tools and seeing Arcane Dimensions and stuff like that, and being reminded like, oh yeah, these old games with their really simple level editor tools have a lot of potential in them. There's a lot of cool stuff you can do. And that for me was the draw, just kind of going back to my roots and trying to understand the history of it and doing that through the act of making levels. There's some anthropologists and like professor anthropologists that try and understand different cultures and different histories by like replicating the acts of, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. And I don't know. I think I started by approaching it as like an anthropologist and like, I'm going to understand these things better if I make a map. So.
Yes, you have a very analytical approach, I've noticed, by reading your blog and definitely on Twitter. And whenever you really take this seriously and you want to kind of break ground and understand it from top to bottom, correct me if I'm wrong, but, that's the impression I get.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, I don't think the maps I've made so far this year have really been you know, they haven't been the most amazing shining gems of maps, but they've all been exercises for me to understand better and work out some new ideas. And in some cases, the more valuable thing for a wider level design community is writing about the level, because like I make a Quake map that's doing some weird thing and release it out into the world. And, you know, maybe a couple dozen people play it if I'm lucky. But you know, if I write about it and that gets traction with level designers who aren't ever going to touch Quake and don't really have any interest in Quake, then that's in some ways a lot more valuable. And that's kind of bringing these learnings forward to a new generation.
And that makes a lot of sense too. The question I was going to ask you was, as a newcomer to Quake, and making all these levels, what has been your biggest challenge when sort of adapting to, in, you know, an older engine and older style of gameplay?
Well, I'm not sure it's really an older engine. Like, I'm using Trench Broom, and I think that was really a big motivator for going back to Quake in the first place. If I had to go back to the original tools, I would not. Like, I've looked at Thief as well as a game that'd be really fun to make maps for. Yeah. And there's a big release recently for the, I think it was the 20th anniversary of Thief. And there's a big map pack that just came out of 24 fan-made fan missions. And like, the level editor for that stuff is scary. Like, that is terrifying. I don't want to go and do that. I like that community is amazing, but if I didn't have modern tools, I probably would have been scared off longer than I have been. So I don't know. Does that answer what you're getting at, or is...
Because you, I'm sorry, you mentioned that your levels recently haven't been sort of, I guess, what you would call, how did you put it?
Shining gems of levels.
Shining gems, put it like, right.
You know.
I disagree, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So what about it do you think makes it so they're not shining gems? Like, is there something about the design that is you're not grasping, or do you think it's a harder game to make for? Or
I think for me, it's that I'm impatient. You know, I designed Maz Attack as my first Quake map, and I got it out there pretty fast. And that was really with the intent of, like, it's very easy to fall into the trap of, I'm going to make this perfect thing. My first map needs to be the best, so I'm going to sit on it and keep polishing it, whatever. And I did that with Unreal Tournament back in the day, and I didn't want to do that again. So I think Maz Attack I made in, like, 2 weeks or something.
Oh, wow.
And definitely rough around the edges, and... That's, I don't think, including like a couple weeks before that of trying out ideas and throwing them away really fast just to learn the tools. But, you know, then after that one, I got feedback. A lot of it was saying the map feels kind of deathmatch-like, which makes sense. I do multiplayer mostly. So I did Simplex as a, let's take those ideas from Maz Attack and do it in a way that more deeply understands, more deeply replicates what's actually good about Quake single player levels, especially, I think I just played the, Dopa expansion. I forget what the actual dimension of something,
Dimensions of the past.
Yeah.
Yeah. The machine games episode. That's really good. Like, it's not Arcane Dimensions quality visuals, but the level design is world-class, like just excellent level design. And I played through that and it's like, okay, let's make a level like that. Let's do still some of the weirdness that I enjoyed with Maz Attack, but let's do basically the best high quality thing I can do. And then I'll go back to fiddling around with goofy mechanics and gimmicks and this kind of experimental stuff that I've been doing since that one. And I think if I want to, excuse me, if I want to create a shining gem of a map, I would really do another Simplex. I would go back to that, polish it, and make more maps like that, and, you know, possibly build out a whole episode in the style of something like Dopa, because I feel like there is a very high bar for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I agree. You know, RC and I were talking earlier about Simplex, and we were both big fans. I like all your maps, but I think that one's the kind of your more traditional linear, still nonlinear elements to it, but you had some really beautiful puzzles. And, you know, let's put it this way. When you play Andrew Yoder map, you kind of know it right off the bat. You have some visual motifs that you use. Your colors are, they're not off the mark, but they're very striking and I don't want to say simplistic, but I guess they are. I mean, you don't use a lot of colored lighting. You're using textures more for that kind of variation in tone and things. But so going to Ruins of Mazatak, you definitely made a splash when that came out. I know people really pricked up their ears because you hear, oh, it's my first map. And you're like, oh, okay, I'll check that out. And I always seek out first mappers because I do the tutorials. So I want to try to, you know, and then I'm like, this guy's a pro. I could tell. he either has experience in some other game, which it was true, and or he's a professional. So Simplex is a really fantastic map. And we're going to have all links to all this stuff and your blog and everything so people can find this in the show notes. But talk about what you've learned, because I know you make multiplayer maps for a living. Have you learned from Quake, doing single player content for Quake, something, you know, have you learned something that can translate into your day job?
Yeah, so not to get too much into it, but I started picking up Quake. You know, I was at Hi-Rez previously doing multiplayer level design, and I was kind of trying to figure out, you know, what's my next move. I've been here for a couple of years, and I picked up Quake as a way to, among those other reasons I described earlier, but I picked it up as a way for me to learn single player level design, because I really hadn't had a reason to learn single player level design. And I made those first two maps and a couple other scraps, I think, before I left Hi-Rez and before I went to this current job.
Did anything, you know, this linear kind of monstery type of single player experience, has that kind of informed your day job? You know, kind of a general question, really.
I can't really go into what I'm working on, but the lessons I learned from making these Quake maps definitely has been helpful. And like prior to doing that, my understanding of single player level design was mostly theoretical and not really applied. And there's a huge distance between like theoretical knowledge and applied knowledge. So
of course,
it's very useful to actually get my hands dirty and see, like, you know, I made Mazatak and the feedback was, wow, this feels like a deathmatch map. And it's like, oh, of course it does. And then going on to the next one and being like, okay, let's do this right. Let's deeply study what makes these DOPA maps work. And I think I'd also just played Last of Us at the time. Mm-hmm. And the Naughty Dog guys and girls, the Naughty Dog developers have just such an amazing sense of pacing between narrative beats and character development. And they don't ever have a room that's just doing one thing. Like a hallway is also a character development moment. And like a combat room turns into a puzzle room, or a puzzle room turns into a combat room. And it's just, like, that is the high bar of craft in the industry for that kind of level design. You know, right. Simplex, I was thinking, okay, how do I, with the limited tools I have, how do I get that kind of pacing where I've got a combat beat and then a puzzle beat, and maybe the combat beat turns into a puzzle beat, or the puzzle beat turns into a combat beat, and that kind of, without also feeling like it's not Quake. Which, I don't know, I think there's some refinement I could do there. I think some of the feedback was maybe it's a little too Explore Jam feeling, but...
Well, personally, I love Explore Jam stuff, so if you want to go further into that realm, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I think maps that have exploration are definitely, I lean towards those, not because I'm horrible at games. I am horrible at games, but no, I just like that break that you get. And you talked about pacing with Last of Us. That's the deal. And I loved, we keep talking about Simplex, but it was really nice because I was paying attention once you released Mazatak, and we kind of hit up a casual friendship. And I was definitely paying attention to the next map. And I think I beta tested it.
Yeah, you did. Version. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it was really cool to see that next step, and it was just like a leap, you know? So very cool. So I think you've come a long way, baby. But let's talk about recursion a little bit, because I got to be honest with you, as much as I love Simplex, I don't think I've finished recursion.
Recursion's weird.
I kept going at it and going at it. And, it's a beautiful map, but talk about that guy.
Yeah, so I think I'm forgetting the exact timeline on these things, but I was at GDC last year, the Game Developers Conference, for those who don't know. And I gave a talk and then met a bunch of people in the level design community and talked with them. And one of these ideas that kept coming up in my mind, and I even wrote some notes on my blog, I think, was about this idea of playgrounds and parks and the way that those are designed to achieve many different, like they're designed for many different people and many different play styles, basically, and they still work. Like, that's a really amazing accomplishment. And why aren't we as level designers thinking about that? And one of the exercises I did on my flight back from San Francisco to Georgia was reimagining Doom if it was designed with this kind of park mentality, and what that would mean for the level design and the game systems and all of that stuff. And I had this list, and I think it's on my blog, I'm not sure. And I then thought, okay, well, what can I actually do without needing to program? And that's basically recursion. And the closest analogy I can think of to existing level design trends is like Mario 64, where it's a lot more open-ended. It's a lot more like you've got a world to explore. The world kind of persists between your interactions with it. I mean, the key gimmick of recursion is that it kicks you out after you achieve one of the four objectives. And that's straight up Mario 64. You find one of the stars, it kicks you out. You go back in, the level is reset.
Right.
I think the downside of it in the case of Quake is that enemies are a lot more aggressive. And with recursion, if you aren't really up for that challenge, then and that's not to... you know, I'm not a great Quake player either, and the skill range is all over the place. Some of the feedback I got in Mazatec and Simplex was I was too simple, or the enemies were too easy. And I saw other people, saw demos that was like, that person's really struggling. So it's always a hard thing.
It is called Simplex, though, right? You're like, hey, it's called Simplex. It's
simple. Yeah. That I was thinking, I don't remember why I named it that. I forget.
You're thinking of my brain. I'm the mayor of Simpleton over here. But I will say recursion, it's not a knock on it. I mean, it's really one of the reasons I wanted to have.
I'll just say I liked it. Not to interrupt, but I liked it.
Yeah. No, and you're a better player. So I think part of the issue was that it was such a new concept for me, and I was struggling a little bit with the combat. Although, I may have finished it actually, because I'm looking at the screenshots right now. But the reason I wanted to have you on the show, Andrew, is because you are definitely breaking new ground in Quake with just a handful of releases, and so that's really refreshing. You also have as I mentioned before, with your texture work and your lighting, everything, it's really solid feel. And we know, I could look at a screenshot and know it's your map. But you are breaking new ground. So that's something to be applauded. And you know that you're going to have to throw some of the waffles out, right? You know, that expression, you're going to break some eggs along the way or what? I don't know. It's some cooking metaphor that I'm screwing up.
Okay.
Insert cooking metaphor.
Yes. Thank you. In other words, you're going to have varying degrees of success. Let's put it that way.
Of course.
And I realized in prepping for this interview that I hadn't played your SM 186, your terracotta map. So yeah. I played that yesterday. And it's funny because you see a little bit of recursion in that map.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. So it was definitely kind of another evolution. So don't beat yourself up too much. You know, you're doing challenging. You're doing challenging work.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, this kind of anthropological approach to using Quake maps, the tools are so simple and the limits are just low enough that it's really easy to say, hey, I've got an idea. Okay, so I can't do that idea exactly, but if I tweak it a little bit, then I can really quickly put this together and test it out and then get feedback and see like, hey, are people interested in this? Is this a fruitful way to keep exploring? And like, I think with recursion, there are some people, it was a very love hate sort of thing. There's some people who are like, oh yes, more of this, but like make the paths longer. or more varied or than other people. I just like, no, it was boring and repetitive. And, and you know, there's, it's definitely a sort of audience thing. But yeah, I think it was a valuable experiment. And that was also really a case cool. where like I wrote up a blog post about it. And I think the blog post is probably as valuable as the level itself in a way, because you know, I was able to reach out and talk with other level designers in the bigger level design community and not just the Quake community based on those ideas. And I don't know, that's interesting.
So tell the audience a little bit about Happy Quake, because they may not follow you on Twitter. And I know you're probably busy with other things, but is there any movement on that, or have you kind of learned any lessons that you're going to, that will inform maybe a future project?
Yeah. So for those who aren't familiar with that, which is probably most people, because I haven't really talked about it a whole lot. Happy Quake, or I've called it Toy Box, or like Sandbox Quake, is basically a continuation of the ideas from Recursion, where it's like, how do we take real world playgrounds, real world parks that you can play them many different ways. You can approach them from like, ooh, I'm going to climb all over this, or I'm going to just kind of sit and relax and chill. How do I apply that to level design? And Happy Quake is another look at that, where it's partly it's an aesthetic choice of like, how do I make it so that Quake is more welcoming and it's not spooky and scary, and make it more like a fun hangout place. Like the best Mario levels and the best Banjo-Kazooie levels are places I just want to hang out, right?
And definitely.
That's not something that really gets done with first-person shooters. Like Halo's, the original Halo has some great levels like that, where it's just like, I just want to drive my car around and, oh, there's some monsters, I'll go fight them when I'm ready, right? It's that kind of attitude is what I've been trying to build some levels around. So I've got the one level built out for it, and it's this very silly playground. There are a lot of different ways of getting to the structure, and it's kind of sandboxy. And yeah, I might release it on its own, but I'd like to make another map or two for it first so I can release as kind of a pack and be like, here are three different explorations of this idea. Here's, you know, here's kind of a statement of argument about what we could do moving forward. And again, that's one of those things I'd probably record some videos and write some blog posts and whatever, and use it as a way of demonstrating these ideas to a wider audience of level designers, not just the Quake community, which.
Yeah.
Who knows if it gets traction, but yeah.
You have a very good perspective of recording history, and I just think it all makes sense now because you're a history major and on the things that you're interested in history of video games. So it's nice to have someone like you interested in the history of gameplay ideas. And I mean, selfishly, I would love you to focus more on Quake. I know you have, but I hope to see that pack moving forward, because at the very, very least, like I said, you could have something. Not everybody's going to love it because they like their, you know, dark and spooky and dramatic stuff, but it might inspire other gameplay ideas moving forward, you know, where people kind of steal from you a little bit. And I think that'd be, I think it's worth exploring this, and if you're compelled to do it, you've got to do it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where like I look at the Doom mapping community and the diversity both of ideas and map creators is a lot better than the Quake community. The Quake, like, I was kind of hesitant when I first got into Quake mapping because there's kind of a stigma about the hardcore Quake guys, kind of the Not you guys, but, you know, the kind of grumpy...
Whatever are you talking about?
You know, the PC gamer... get off my lawn, Quake guys.
Oh, I'm well aware of them.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at Doom, and maybe those people existed in the Doom community at some point, but, like, they've been shouted down so far that, like, I don't see them anymore. The Doom community does, like, if you do some wild, weird stuff, they're like, that's awesome, right? They want to embrace all these weird ideas. And as a result, you get creators that, like I said, it's a more diverse community. It's not just a bunch of old white guys be nostalgic about the game they played as kids, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think part of the Doom thing though is it is a little easier to get into. I'm not arguing with you, but I mean the tools, I mean you could sit down and make a really decent Doom level in one session as a beginner, as opposed to Quake. It's like, oh boy, you guys were talking on Unreal Ed, you know, just like, oh my God, what is this? I'm closing it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
In fact, I had a kid. I say he's a kid because I went and checked out his YouTube channel. I'm like, oh, he's a kid. He put a comment on one of my tutorials. This is too freaking complicated. Why doesn't someone just make a, you know, whatever it was, Snap Map or something like that?
Oh, geez.
So it's pretty funny. So yeah, I think that's part of it. But yes, I agree. The Doom community is much larger. And I think those grumps have been driven underground, like you said.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I can say, one of the best things about Hi-Rez is it's actually a pretty diverse company. Like the level design team I was working with had people from different ethnic backgrounds and a pretty good male-female ratio, pretty good diversity across the team. And like that's HR department is all over that, and that's awesome for them. And it meant that when you were trying to problem solve stuff, I didn't just get back the kind of answers I expected when I said like, oh, how do we do this? I would get stuff that I had never, ever considered because they played different games growing up. They read different books growing up. They lived in different parts of the country or different parts of the world. And, you know, the Quake community is not so much that. You do get some kind of national diversity. You get a lot of Eastern European and I guess Europe in general, you get a lot of. But I don't know, just more diversity and more different voices. Like I'd love to see somebody try and make, you know, a farming game basically, or like what is a true dungeon crawl look like in Quake, or like what does a walking sim look like in Quake? Because the tools, you can totally make a walking sim with Quake and it'd be awesome, right? But we aren't really seeing that yet. And that's something I'm really hopeful for.
All right, Andrew. So I see here that you've actually worked a lot with Unreal as well. You want to talk a little bit about that? Because
yes.
Unreal is actually a series that I'm not super familiar with past Unreal Tournament. So what was that like for you?
Yeah, I know it's a little bit of sacrilege or maybe it makes me a heretic if I'm...
Look at that.
No, it's like I said, when I was growing up, my family had a couple games around, Unreal Tournament was around, and it's one of the first maps I played. You know, rural community, so really bad internet quality, and that meant playing against bots, and Unreal Tournament was one of those where all the modifiers and mutators were kind of the point. You didn't really play the vanilla Unreal Tournament. So, you know, just hours of like slow-mo, big head mode, sniping
right
bots on facing
Yeah, those
worlds.
Mutators were a lot of fun.
Yeah. And it kind of felt like game design in a way. Like, here's basically the game was a sandbox of these tools with mutators. So you snap in some different mutators and suddenly you're basically playing a different game.
And right.
I don't know. That was, I think, a formative experience.
So that's cool. After the mutators, you actually started doing actual level design, it looks like, though.
Yeah. Yeah. I forget when exactly it was, but at some point... I was talking with an older family friend who also played Unreal Tournament and built computers and did stuff like that. This kind of tech influence in my life. And he was telling me there's a level editor with it. And I was like completely blown away. There's a level editor. I can make my own maps. So I found where the executable for it was and I opened it up. And I opened up CTF Face, which is Facing Worlds. And it was kind of terrifying. Like if you guys have ever used the Unreal Editor... especially, I guess this would be Unreal Engine 2. They're like dragon-headed icons, and there are apple icons, which are path nodes for the bots. And these are like okay. everywhere. And it's like, here be dragons and apples. Mm-hmm. And I think I like clicked something and moved something, and I was so terrified I was going to break the map and never be able to play it again that I closed out and was like, not touching that again.
There was no dump truck tutorial for that.
No, though. There wasn't. There wasn't.
Where were you?
Yeah, those tools were, I could probably go back to them now because I've used Unreal Engine so much and there's actually a lot of continuity between the older Unreal Engines and what the current ones are. I guess Unreal Engine 4 is kind of the big leap, but I haven't really used that one much. But yeah, at some point I picked up Unreal Engine 2.5. I'd say this is like junior high or something, and went through a bunch of tutorials with that and learned a lot of the basics and like the paradigms of how to think and level editor ease. And at the same time, there's also a Far Cry game for, I think it was Xbox 360, that had this really rudimentary level editor tool for it. And I built dozens and dozens of maps in these two different things. So I had like the technical chops growing with Unreal Engine 2.5 and the actual level design theory practice stuff developing with Far Cry. And that had a pretty active mapping community, at least active enough for me to get feedback and see that my maps were being played, or see that they weren't and try and figure out why. So it was a very useful way to kind of churn through a lot of the bad maps and a lot of the bad theories of what makes a good map.
And you have a good exposure to two different styles of mapping, because I know that Far Cry, I remember playing with the Far Cry editor on PC, and then also the Far Cry editor for Far Cry 2. And it's this kind of, you know, isometric view, God view, and you're kind of pulling and stretching terrain, and then you can jump down in first person. It's a lot different kind of methodology that you have like with Unreal, where you're carving, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're carving with CSG volumes out of space. So it's much more kind of corridor-ish, corridor shooter-ish kind of construction. Whereas, you know, Far Cry, you've got this vast, almost like a flight sim type of thing.
Yeah, I think the level editor tools for Far Cry on the consoles were a lot more limited than the PC versions, which isn't too surprising. But yeah, you've got that about right. The earlier version of Unreal that I was learning in was entirely subtractive, and that's a very different paradigm from Quake, but it's still CSG. The end level result basically ends up being the same, but it's like the whole world is solid and you're subtracting rooms from it. And the Far Cry editor was instead an additive world without any CSG, no primitives, and you've got terrain, and the terrain's got to do a ton of the job for you because you don't have CSG. And it's like, okay, now let me drop in a building. This building is always going to be this kind of building. I can't move the door on it. That door is where it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if I want to create, if I want like the outline of this building, but I don't want to have the interior, then I've got to block it off somehow. And there's a lot of very hacky kind of kit bash approach to level design, almost more like environment art.
Right. I was going to say, because you're also dealing with blending terrain and textures on terrain, which is something we'd never would touch unless you're making textures in the Quake. So you've got this other skill at having done that. It's just so strange. It's so interesting to try these different approaches. I don't, RC, have you ever tried one of those Far Cry editors, even in the, like on a console? Cause they are kind of fun to fiddle around with.
No, I haven't. I remember opening Unreal Editor, or the game engine when it went free. And I had the same experience of like, and then I closed it. So.
Yeah, at least with, I think where I made the real big leap from dabbling in these different tools was with Unreal Tournament 3 came out, and I got a special edition that came with a disc with a whole bunch of tutorials on it. It was like 24 hours worth of tutorials. And I got this, it was either for like Christmas or my birthday or something. This would be the end of 2007, the start of 2008. And I'm pretty sure I spent like the next 24 hours watching these tutorials and replicating like, oh, pause, let me try and do the same thing in my, like, tutorials make a huge difference.
So you were bitten by the game design bug like way back when then.
Yeah. Like even, one of my favorite games is Banjo-Kazooie on the N64. And
likewise, love it.
Wonderful, charming game. It's kind of hard to go back to in some ways. Maybe I've just gone back to it enough times that the kind of nostalgic glimmer has worn off. But
right.
Yeah, games like that, Legend of Zelda as well, Ocarina of Time, those games were like, oh, this is great, and I've played a bunch of it, and I wish there was more. Let me get out some paper and draw some maps. And or like, you know, what if there was a cooler sword in Legend of Zelda? What if that sword was on fire? That'd be so cool. You know, dumb stuff like that, but it's it's the kind of rudimentary game and level design that I think a lot of people get drawn into.
Well, it's really cool, though. It's interesting to see that you kind of went to Unreal and, you know, you were working on maps and working on, you know, mutations and that kind of thing throughout the, you know, UT series. But when it finally came time for you to go to college, you actually didn't really go into game design, it looks like.
No, and there's a variety of reasons for that. You know, small rural hometown, and
right,
really the one saving grace of my hometown is that it's also a university town. And, you know, I had a pretty rough final year of high school. And it was one of those things where it's like, you know, I'd hoped that going out of high school with this kind of ambitious, hubris, I guess would be the word for it, that I could just do the Cliffy B thing and go straight into a game job, because that's
right,
what Cliffy B did. And, you know, it's not the '90s anymore, or it wasn't at the time. So it became pretty clear that I need to go to college, and I ended up just going to the hometown college, which, you know, I wasn't too happy with that. But like I said, it was kind of a rough time of trying to figure out what I was doing. So,
well, I think, you know, honestly, I have I have one college aged kid and I have a 16-year-old, and, you know, as a parent, you're just like, don't do anything creative. Don't do anything.
yep.
But honestly, you know,
absolutely. Like, I got the newspaper clippings from my parents about, like, here's a summer job for you. Meanwhile, I'm building levels and not making any money from it. Right.
Right. But, so, but see, now looking back on that, cause to finish the kind of the thought, he became a history major and some other things I want to ask you about later, but, so it hasn't really kept you from getting game design jobs, has it?
No, but I mean, it was, I think the industry's at this, like, very lucky timing, basically. Mm-hmm. It's at this pivot where I think the people who, like the lead level designers in different studios, those are mostly old guard folks. They go back a ways, and a lot of them don't have game design degrees because those programs didn't exist when they were going up through their developing their experience. So they don't care if you have a degree, but HR does. And if you're applying at a company big enough that HR filters before it even gets to the people who actually are going to be working with you, then they'll see, oh, this guy's got a degree in history. Let's just off into the recycle bin. And that was actually the case with the job I worked at Hi-Rez. Apparently the lead level designer had to go check with HR and see, like, hey, is there anything you've discarded that, like, these, I'm looking for a guy. And apparently my resume was fished out of recycling. He's like, that's the guy. I can't recommend, you know, for people listening to this who want to do this professionally, I honestly don't know how important a game design degree is. Probably it helps with getting through HR, but I don't know. It's tough. I spent a long time trying to get in.
Yeah, I was going to say it probably took you a while to land that as well, because there's so much competition. It's so much volatility in the industry from my perspective, from just an outsider's perspective.
Yeah, I think the burnout rate for level designers is still like 5 years, which... Yep.
Yikes.
I think I'm coming up on a little over 3.
When they fished your resume out of the recycle bin, I mean, was that, you know, did you submit one by a, you know, somebody saying, hey, work here type of thing? Did you have a connection, or how did that come?
No, I had no connection, which is also a huge factor. Even with this job at Digital Extremes where I'm working now, I think, even with my experience at Hi-Rez, my resume might have just been completely looked over if I didn't have a connection. So it's a tough industry to get into, even once you have a couple of years of actual experience. I think, you know, probably now I'd find it easier, but and also that's not to be too mean to the HR department. Like, I'm sure they get tons of applicants and they have no way of gauging whether somebody's actually qualified or not. So, like, that's not an easy job. If I were in their position, I probably would have dumped my resume in the recycling as well.
I don't know. I would hire myself 10 times over. But that's
you gotta, you know, just pat yourself on the back a little bit every now and then.
Yeah, I'd be like, this guy's really cool.
Yeah.
So when you got into work on Paladins, what exactly was your job description? Like, what did you work on?
Yeah, so the game was at a pretty early point. This is mostly, I think I joined the day that we went into closed beta.
Okay.
So the first day you could purchase the game and have a beta key and play the game. And it was very mobile-like, but with a first-person perspective. And we had these huge maps that had three different capture points and massive bases. And you had horses. And this is a first-person shooter. And, you know, kick you to the third person when you're on the horse. And I don't know. For me, it was just like a total mind bender, because when I'd applied for the job and what I'd seen of gameplay footage that had been out so far, I thought it was like Team Fortress, but it was actually basically a MOBA with first person camera. But the game changed a whole lot over the next few months of closed beta. Like, it was basically a completely different game several times over, and the level design had to keep up with those changes. And, you know, you look at gameplay footage now, it's totally different game from when I joined on, and I think for the better. And I'd like to think that at least part of that is because of the work I was able to do as a level designer to make it the game that it is now.
And I guarantee it. I'm sure that's the case.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you have written extensively on your blog, and also you had the GDC talk. So do you want to get into that a little bit and see kind of how that came about and how you were able to speak on the matter?
So really the main conflict I was feeling within the game's identity and the game's design was this balance between being a competitive game or being a sort of casual, more accessible multiplayer game. And our leanings kind of went back and forth over time. And you design maps and gameplay systems very differently based on those motivations. With the competitive, from a business perspective, the idea is you can do the kind of League of Legends thing. You can do the path to pro where there's esports, and that has the virtuous cycle of esports viewership and people playing ranked games and wanting to become pros themselves and all of that stuff. And if you aim for that, then the maps need to be very symmetrical and very balanced. And the character design also needs to be very symmetrical and balanced, and, or at least not have any huge outliers. You don't want any, you know, like Smash Bros, they can have these huge outliers where it's like, this character is the best because it's a casual game, or they try and keep it casual. And that was really the question. Are we the Smash Bros of first-person shooters, or are we the League of Legends of first-person shooters? And most of the time that I was on the project, we were trying to make it more like League of Legends, more competitive focused. And really, it was in the last half year that I was on that project that we said, well, wait a second. We've got this huge player base that doesn't want the thing we've been trying to make. Like, they're still playing the game, they still enjoy it, but they care about, like, we added a team deathmatch mode and people really liked that. And it's like, okay, well, cool. There's this part of the audience that we can't just keep giving them these very symmetrical, balanced, competitive maps, because they don't want to play those as much as these weird, gimmicky, goofy, you know, the last couple of maps I designed on Paladins have jump pads. They're asymmetrical. They're like, they've got these strong visual theming elements. They'd be terrible competitive maps. And it was just a fun realization of like, oh yeah, that's an audience too. Those are still people who play the game, and this is a way to give them something. And I don't know. Does that make sense?
Definitely. You know, I think it's interesting when you're designing anything that, you know, because you, whether you're working alone or with a team, you're sort of always in this bubble. So you're always thinking, you know, this has to be this thing, you know, like you were talking about how, you know, we're either going for this or that, League of Legends or Super Smash Brothers. But in the end, it's like, well, it could actually be a couple of other things that are added in too. You know, we could have deathmatch from Quake. And it's just really cool to hear that, you know, things evolve to a point where it's like, oh, wow, this isn't even what we thought it was going to be when we started.
Yeah, and I'm oversimplifying it a little bit. My GDC talk went more in depth to it. It was like the title of my GDC talk was The Holy Grail of Level Design, where the idea is that you could serve both audiences with the same levels. And that basically we found that to not be the case. Like, there was a little bit of overlap between the more casual players and a little bit of overlap with the competitive players, but mostly it seemed like we were better off catering to them separately and saying like, okay, here's a map that's just ridiculous and the competitive players are never going to touch it. Now here's a map that's like super competitive and boring a little bit for the casual players.
Yeah.
But esports on that map is going to be amazing, right?
Like, right.
You know, that's, mm-hmm. that's the balance. That's kind of the conclusion that I think, or at least that's the direction that I was working with the team toward when I left. I don't know where it's been since then. So,
yeah. And, you know, obviously because you haven't been on the team, but one thing I'll definitely say about multiplayer games nowadays is that not only because Dump Truck was talking about competition even within the industry to get jobs and stuff, but the competition of releasing a multiplayer game nowadays is, oof, man. Like,
yeah, yeah.
That Paladins has sort of like made a splash somewhere is actually pretty impressive.
Yeah. And it was a really tough time because, you know, Overwatch came out, Battleborn came out, Battleborn, right. Like, at the time that Battleborn came out, we were kind of still pretty MOBA-ish. And we were like in that middle ground between Battleborn and Overwatch. And then you see that Battleborn didn't do so well for a variety of reasons. Clearly, a lot of love went into that game. And despite that, it still didn't land. And then we're sitting there like, oh, is that us next? And
right,
it was scary. There were even I like bet. Quake Champions that... like, or the new Unreal Tournament, it, I don't know. It's very surprising to me. I think part of it is, games have moved from, it used to be that Quake is like what you play or Unreal Tournament is what you play. And then you had mods and mutators to make it whatever you wanted it to be. And it's different now. It's, I don't know. I think there's this false perception that the arena shooters had this really strong appeal when it's really the modifiers on them that made them into their own games that had the strong appeal.
Right, right.
So you see people bring back like Lawbreakers or Quake Champions, and they're thinking like, oh yeah, those good old days of the classic arena shooter. And most people are like, nah, you know, I like this team multiplayer mod or this really weird asymmetrical grappling hook mod, or, you know, I like big head mode with, you know, rockets that you can ride on and stuff like that. And I think that's where battle royales have really taken off because they can do a lot more of those things. Like Fortnite has this huge range of appeal. You can play it hardcore, you can play it casual, and either way it's going to come up with stories that you can share with your friends. And that's, you know, like the way I played PUBG was basically as a road trip sim. Like, me and my friends get in the car, let's go. We're bound to die. We know it's not going to end well, but what kind of adventures will we have on the way? Yeah.
Yeah.
And we could do that right alongside people who were trying to like win. And that didn't ruin our experience, which, you know, you do that in like a Paladins match where there's a try hard and people just goofing off. And that's going to be a terrible match for both players. Right. So I think we're seeing a new a kind of renaissance or like a rebirth of what multiplayer is or should be. And that to me is pretty exciting.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned Fortnite because I know that game gets a lot of hate from the more like hardcore Quake community and everything. I've actually been spending this past season 6 playing Fortnite just to kind of experiment with it because I haven't played it. And I actually find it to be a lot like Quake, and just like you were saying, in the idea that what makes it fun are all these different like modded game modes that they come up with. Just over season 6, I think they came up with like 6 different ways to play the game. Like one had you capturing a node by doing a silly dance on it. And then another one, you know, had you freezing people and stuff like that. There's just like all kinds of really cool stuff in there. And I think that's really what keeps people going. Just like, as you said, people did the same thing with Quake back in the 90s. So definitely related there. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. I think even like we saw a little bit with TF2 where there was a pretty clear pivot once they added Steam achievements and like really built out the Steam achievements for it that, you know, it was more about people, I'm going to play Pyro and work my way through this list of achievements, basically.
Right.
And I don't know, it feels like the open world sandbox game turned multiplayer in a way, which I guess has been like Grand Theft Auto Online's domain. But I don't know, I feel like there's this really interesting cross-pollination going on. In some ways, it's like going back to Ultima Online, right?
Yeah, and a lot of these, each game is an iteration of the genre itself. So you have, you've got people, millions or hundreds of thousands of people playing Grand Theft Auto Online, and so it just makes it easier for all the other games that come after it to have that kind of sandboxy type of entree. You know what I mean? It's whereas it's kind of interesting because I played Quake Champions yesterday for the first time since the initial release, because I felt I was going to get a question eventually from RC about it. So, but it's interesting how it's come along. But it's also interesting. It's like sitting here going, I just want to kill people. I don't want to see all these animations, and I don't want all these challenges. I just would like to blow things up and kill things. And so it's funny how far things have come in these 20 years, you know.
Yeah,
I'm a Quake dad, so I'll own it.
I think there are kind of two sides to that. One of them is, as a business, like the business side of this is really messy and weird, and it's been going all sorts of places, and you know that affects game design and game art and game systems. So you have cosmetics, and you have, I don't know if Quake Champions has loot boxes, but you know a lot of these games do.
They have three different kinds.
Okay. Yep.
Backpacks. There's backpacks, and then what, the little vault?
Chest.
Yeah, chest, and then
there's the reliquary or something
like
that.
Yeah, reliquary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think though, like the positive side of those things is, like, can you imagine Quake with an emote wheel, like old school Quake with an emote wheel, or like
totally.
a dance menu? Like that's something that is awesome because you get players expressing themselves and talking to each other non-verbally in a way where you don't have to disclose information about yourself. You can like wave and be nice or all that stuff. I guess Unreal Tournament had an emote wheel kind of.
UT99 definitely had the jest kind of key, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think most of them were taunts though. I think
right.
They weren't very friendly.
That makes it a lot more fun though.
Yeah.
Come on. But no, I can see it. It's just, it's funny to see to the degree that you have this, you know, part of it's monetization, part of it, I'm sure, is like back end stuff where it's like, okay, well, we've got a match make, so we've got to stall for a few minutes, you know, right? While we're all connecting, you know, players and matchmaking and all that. So I know there's a variety of reasons for it, but it is kind of striking to see like, well, boy, this is a long, like when I played Overwatch the first time, I'm like, wait, how long do we have to wait?
Yeah.
I mean, why are we sitting here?
I mean, I think the positive side of it is that we are getting more player expression and more ways for players to construct identity. Maybe not so much in like hero shooters and MOBAs where you're playing as a character, but I don't know, games where you can set your armor a different color and you can have your different emotes. I think that's cool.
As soon as skins came out for Quake 1 or Quake World, I should say, people were all over it. And then they just went, you know, they took it to the next level with Quake 2 and then so on. Mm-hmm. So I get it. And it's there's just something undeniable about making something your own. You know, so I'm certainly not knocking it, but it's definitely there's an adjustment phase to it. One thing I was talking to RC about this. One thing is the HUD in Quake Champions is still too much for me, even though you can tick off a few things. My son came in and watched me and says, "Where are the numbers?" I'm like, "I don't want to see this. I don't want to see the numbers. I hear the horn honk. I'm good. You know, I'm hurting the guy. And when I die, I'll just respawn." And so I appreciate that you can kind of limit those. But boy, I loved UT99 in that case because you could really, if I'm not getting it wrong, you could really customize that thing to your heart's desire. You could have no numbers on the screen if you
wanted. The main menu for Unreal Tournament 99 basically looks like its own operating system.
Yeah.
It's the worst UI ever, but like there's so much customization you can do. You could change your crosshair. You could do all sorts of stuff. It was quite the game. In some ways, quite ahead of its time. In other ways, very much a product of its times.
And now,
aren't
one
we
thing.
All?
I am.
Yeah, yeah.
Get off my Quake lawn. I'm a Quake dad. Get off my lawn. No, I will say, RC, I will tell you that I was the top of the leaderboard for one match on longest yard. So I think I'll start kind of jumping back into Quake Champions, I'm sure.
Wow, that was pretty good.
Nice.
I mean, you know, it was pretty pathetic. I played for probably 25 minutes and like, hey, wait, how am I on top of the leaderboard?
Because the bots were set to easy. That's
no, there was human beings. These are team deathmatch human beings.
That's what they want you to think.
Right. Oh, see that?
Right, yeah. But I will now. I just went on a tirade against all this user interface stuff and loot boxes. But I will say, I was looking at the Death Knight for probably like 10 minutes yesterday, just going, oh, that's really cool. And how to. And I got this weird head for him now. And ooh, what color? Oh, this is so it does suck you in big time.
Yeah. I'm curious to see where it goes because it feels like, I don't know, it feels like we are still in this camp. Maybe it's just the ongoing turbulence and we won't ever settle back down. Maybe that's just the nature of these things. But it feels like the hero shooters were a thing. And everybody's clamoring to make a hero shooter. And then that kind of passed. People said, okay, Overwatch, you win. And then PUBG came out. It's like, oh, hero shooters aren't the next thing. It's battle royales. And now we've kind of handed the crown to Fortnite. And it's like, okay, well, what's next? Because there are these lessons that are being passed from one game to the next, where Fortnite clearly has some Overwatch influence in it. And also some League of Legends influence in both. And it's just like, okay, well, what's the evolution here?
It also kind of feels like to me just, and you guys might laugh at me, but I never played Minecraft. I saw my kids play it, but I never touched it. But it feels like it's, you know, that game wouldn't exist in its current form without Minecraft's success.
Absolutely.
Because you've got the constructing part of it as well. So I was actually kind of I was excited to hear that Fortnite did well because it came out at a time it was very crowded and there was all kinds of stuff going on. And I don't know the business side of this game very well. I don't follow it that closely, but I kind of root for some of these companies to kind of hang in there and not fold and not make these big disastrous releases. And so I was happy that they found success. I don't know if you guys want to comment on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think Epic is still, like, they still own the Unreal Engine and they still get a license. If you license the engine, you pay them some cut. I don't know exactly. I'm not on the business side of things. Mm-hmm. So they don't need Fortnite to be successful. in the same way, they don't need Unreal Tournament or Paragon to succeed. In some ways, at least this is my understanding. Maybe I'm totally wrongheaded on this, but those games, Paragon especially, is like a really good tech demo that really sells the engine. And they made all those assets free for people using Unreal Engine 4. So it's really like, hey, come use Unreal Engine 4. Come make games and we'll make our cut off of that way. So I'm not sure Fortnite's a case where phew, Epic is still alive. I think they'd still be doing just fine without it. But
right. Thank you. I appreciate it. Because I like I say, I don't follow it. I follow the industry, but I just not this whole side of it. In fact, most of my information is from Twitter these days.
Got to be careful.
That's scary.
Yeah. I know. Well, I'm clicking on Polygon now to look at Paragon because I'm like, what the hell is Paragon?
it was a MOBA. But, it was also in that kind of hero shooter phase where it,
it looked like, but they had
Gears of War-y.
Gotcha. MOBA. Yeah, it's a tough release. It looks like they closed it down. So I see.
Yeah, that was in the same period, I think, as Battleborn. And there's Gigantic as well in there and a couple others.
Oh, yeah, Gigantic. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a lot of them. Actually, Paragon, I played a few hours of when in its beta form, and I actually enjoyed it. I was surprised when they said they were shutting it down. I thought it had at least some sort of user base, but I guess not.
Yeah, I'm not sure. A lot of those things are really hard to know unless you're behind the scenes.
Right. But yeah, like you were talking about Dump Truck, as far as Fortnite success and all that other stuff, you know, it's interesting. And as Andrew was pointing out too, the evolution of everything, it's really interesting to see where things take off because it almost seems like the games that become the game that people go to, like Fortnite or Overwatch, for example, both are fun games, but they end up being the culmination of all the other games that came before it. They're like, we're going to perfect it to the point of this. And then people just decide, okay, you know, we're tapping out here. This is the game. And then they try to evolve to whatever the next multiplayer game is going to be. So it's interesting that these games end up being created or started by smaller studios, you know, Indian studios or whatever, or they maybe a bigger studio creates a smaller idea and tries to sort of nurture it and get it bigger. But it would seem as though, you know, the companies that have the money and have the time to create these things like Blizzard or, you know, why am I blanking on this now?
Epic.
Thank you. Or a company like Epic, for example, who have the time and money and everything to pump into these games, they end up being the ones who win in the end. You know, that's why at the time I was actually more rooting for the guys behind the whole PUBG thing, because they were just a team that came from, you know, out of nowhere. And they're like, here's our game. And Fortnite kind of stole like a lot of their thunder there. So,
yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. It's very tempting to see this kind of inevitable march of progress forward as we learn from our past mistakes and as genres evolve and stuff like that. But they're also like, what's flavor of the month? And also there are missteps. Like, you know, I see Fallout 76. And to me, that game as an idea is awesome. I haven't gotten the chance to actually play it yet.
Right.
I know it's had some flack around it, but I look at it though, and I think of Ultima Online. I think of like the old player killing, and I didn't play Ultima Online, but like I've read postmortems on it and I've gone to GDC talks on it. And as a multiplayer designer or somebody who's predominantly done multiplayer, all that stuff's really exciting to me. And I see Fallout 76 and it's like, oh, I wonder if they're learning those lessons. Oh, maybe not. Okay. You know, like apparently they don't, I should look at my facts on this, but there's a problem with player abuse and not having a system to report abuse in Fallout 76. And
oh,
it's
man.
Like, how do you make a game in 2018 that's... I mean, PUBG has the same problem. Like, you go into a match of PUBG with... If you don't already have everybody muted, which is like the first thing I did when I got into that game.
Right.
It's like, okay, how do I actually report somebody? I have to wait till the end of the game, remember their name, manually type it in? What? Like, I don't know. There are some lessons.
Nobody's going
to
do that.
Like, part of the reason I went back to Quake in, you know, earlier this year is because there are all these old lessons that I feel like have been forgotten. And, you know, if we are trying to inevitably progress to some ultimate game or whatever, then it's worth going back and trying to understand what made those old things so good. And maybe we didn't understand when we thought we were carrying those ideas forward, but we didn't really, you know?
So Andrew, it seems like you've definitely accomplished some of the things you set out to do in game design. You work as a professional in the industry. And I know that a lot of other people out there are, you know, they have that as a goal as well. So do you have any advice for newcomers that are looking to accomplish that goal?
Yeah. So I've occasionally been in the position to hire people where I've looked over resumes and looked over portfolios and applications. And often what I see with a lot of people who come out of game design programs especially is that they haven't really mastered any one skill. I see a lot of kind of jack of all trade situations. And I think that makes sense until you understand what your calling is. Like it's good to dabble in programming and art and design. But once you find the thing that you're really into, you know, put in the time and get really good at that. I think the important thing is to develop a craftsmanship or craftspersonship in some area of focus. It's good to dabble and have that range and see whether you like programming or art or design or what exactly. But once you find what area is yours, you've just got to put in the time to get really good at it. Otherwise, what we see when we're looking at those portfolios and those resumes is maybe this person could be an intern. But they haven't put in the hours yet to really, and that's a hard thing to do because for a lot of people, you know, I was a pretty privileged kid growing up where I could put in those hours of the summer instead of having to work a summer job. So it's, yeah, it's tough. If it's something you feels really your calling though, then yeah, you just gotta build up a portfolio and get that craft.
This is RC. Thanks for listening to the Quakecast. You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/watchGGRC.
And I'm Dump Truck. You can find me on YouTube. Just search for Dump Truck _DS. Hello, Quakers. I'm Dump Truck DS, and you're listening to the QuakeCast with my co-host, RC.
Hello.
That's great.
Yeah. When I clicked the link, it prompted me with a, hey, do you want to permanently store this locally? And I said, nope, but allow me to answer that again. Do I need to relaunch this and say yes to that?
It doesn't ask me.
I wonder.
That's weird.
I'm using Firefox, if that makes a difference.
Dump Truck, it doesn't care about your feelings, but it cares about, Andrew's feelings.
Yeah.
I think I had an episode of the Quake Rave where it accidentally was using my webcam mic instead of my normal mic. And it was just like, why can't I hear? Oh my God. No.
Yeah, that's not a fun discovery.
So you had to overdub it like a martial arts movie. I'm playing this game. I will now jump over this barrel here.